Motor City Riffs.
Another WRIF concert.
Now a Saturday show added. The American Badass is back for a second night.
Are you ready?
Saturday, May 13th in the Palace of Auburn Hills. Tickets for the second show on sale now.
Cowboy, badass, and black singing.
Hey.
I feel like Jack.
The Son of Detroit brings it home to the Palace with special guests.
You.
Peter Frampton. Are on sale right now at LiveNation.com, PalaceNet.com, the Palace Box Office, and all Ticketmaster outlets by phone at 248-645-6666. Now he's back to finish the job. Saturday, May 13th at the Palace of Auburn Hills, part of the Miller Lite Concert Series. Look for the new CD, Live Trucker, in stores now.
Okay, fridge pack commercial, take one.
With a convenient handle and a tearaway top, grabbing a beer from a new Miller Lite or Miller Genuine Draft fridge pack is easy. In fact, you might say it's easy as pie.
No, it's not.
Excuse me?
You ever made a pie? It's like a 20-step process. Total hassle.
Oh, right.
Sorry, let's try it again. Fridge pack commercial, take two.
Grabbing beer from a Miller fridge pack is easy as falling off a log.
Lawsuit.
What?
Just saying, someone's going to try to see if that's true, end up with a concussion or broken femur or something.
Fine. Grabbing a beer from a fridge pack is like a walk in the park.
Dangerous. Twist an ankle, pull a hammy, let alone your chance of getting mugged.
The fridge pack is a piece of cake.
Cavities.
The fridge pack is easy as 1, 2, 3...
Ooh, bad at math.
The new fridge pack from Miller. It's cold beer made easy.
Yeah, that'll work.
Thank you. Miller, good call.
4 out of 5 beer drinkers prefer the new Miller fridge pack over the old pack. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Live responsibly.
Unleash your entrepreneurial spirit. Do you understand the power of radio and the fierce loyalty of radio listeners? Are you passionate about growing your client's business while growing your own personal wealth? Are you competitive, creative, and innovative? Do you build strong relationships? Do you love to be challenged? Is your track record one of cooking up solutions clients just can't resist? If you find yourself screaming yes to these questions, we should be talking. WRIF has a rare employment opportunity. We're looking for an account manager in the sales department who comes with a minimum of 3 years sales experience and a personal fighter for success. Send your resume and reasons why you should be considered for this position to sales@wrif.com. No phone calls, please.
When my son started having behavior problems, the total transformation techniques were like the instruction manual on how to deal with him. We got immediate results.
Ever wish your kid came with an instruction manual when he's disrespectful, defiant, or even abusive? Do you know how to fix it? I'm behavioral therapist James Lehman, and I'll show you how to change your child's behavior right now with the Total Transformation. The program that helps you fix every behavior problem under the sun. Defiance, backtalking, lying, acting out in school, even problems with ADD and ADHD. There's no screaming, no fighting, no frustration. The Total Transformation is the program I've used for over 30 years to solve even the worst behavior problems. Your child will listen to you again, and you'll get peace and sanity back into your home. I guarantee it.
Call now and get How to Turn Your Child's Attitude Around in 1 minute or less free with your order. 1-800-325-2185. 1-800-325-2185. Call now. 1-800-325-2185. 1-800-325-2185.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riffs Phone-In Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Boy, am I ready for this show. I've spent most of last week, this week actually, Wednesday through just a few hours ago, in New York City, took part in this massive anti-war demonstration saying, bring all the troops home from Iraq now. 300,000 of us walking down Broadway. So it was quite an event, yet, I don't know, you probably never heard of it, right? Media just ignores it. Demonstrations are everywhere. Also, today, these huge demonstrations demanding action around Darfur in Sudan. Most of us say, what, Darfur, Sudan, what the hell is that? And, of course, what could be the mother of all demonstrations tomorrow, when people will be marching all across the country for immigrant rights. So I'd like to talk about some of that. And trying to think how to try to put this in some order. While I'm thinking about it, I can do two things at once. I'm going to tell you a little about the show because some of you may be joining us for the first time, or you may need a reminder. This is the Night Call Show. My name's Peter Werby, and our phone number here for you to call in, 313-298-WRIF. 298-WRIF, the 313 area code. That's a Detroit, Michigan area code, and that's where we're broadcasting from. Some of you, maybe even many of you, listening all around the country, all around the world on the Internet, but we're primarily broadcasting directly by radio and HD radio into southeastern Michigan, the Detroit area, southern Ontario, our neighbors right across the river, and northern Ohio, that's right. If you'd ever like to email me, calltalkyes@yahoo.com, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And I know many of you from the Detroit area made the trek, like I did, to New York City to take part in the anti-war demonstration. I didn't hook in too much to this Darfur demonstration in Washington. Some of you may have gone to that as well. Please let me know your experiences. Frame this like this. Direct action gets it done. That's what I've always said. Voting, maybe that's like 137th thing you got to do after you've done lots of other things, beginning with critical thinking. And ultimately, that's what this show is about. Learning to think. Now you go, come on, man. Don't get pretentious on me. Listen, all of us are lazy. All of us are lazy thinkers. Who the hell wants to keep thinking about all this stuff all the time, sorting through all the ideas, all the conflicting arguments, all of the details of it? And sometimes just when you think you've made your way to the center of the labyrinth, there's more there. So it's tough. And it's a lot easier to put your trust in people, particularly guys in suits that appear to be successful because they're at the pinnacle of power or wealth, or usually power and wealth. Duh, does it go together? Right. So you're people frequently, I was going to say you, but you know, the shoe fits, wear it. If not, okay, good. But frequently we assign or we relinquish our critical thinking to those in power, those that appear with this great confidence, and they announce their plans, their ideas, their analyses, their commandments, whatever, through the spectacle, the television. And as we know, only powerful people have access to television, the big television. Radio, they even let people like me on, so it's no big deal. Right? And they'll let you on. 313-298-WRIF. Try to get on NBC or Fox or CNN. Can't do it. All right? They never offered me a job, and they're never going to let you. Well, yeah, I guess they have a few of those phone-in programs or something like that. This is where the people talk. This is where we get to talk. The other mediums, that's where the elites talk, and that's where they talk at us. And what they want to do is they want to create ideas in our heads. They want to pass on what they want to accomplish to us. And they have a real head start on it all because there's a whole history of us passively accepting what we're told. Well, it looks finally like things are turning in the other direction. And for those of you who say, well, what should we do? Or on the other hand, people say, oh, well, demonstrations don't do anything. They are manifestations of mass ideas. In other words, ideas that are held by, usually in this case, millions of people. So we know millions and millions and millions, tens of millions of us, the vast majority of us now, oppose Bush's war in Iraq. We know it was based on lies. And so when an event happens, like the demonstration on Saturday, well, we march down Broadway to Foley Square, where the City Hall is. And it wasn't, imagine, wasn't a single arrest. We were all happy about that. The cops behaved themselves, the demonstrators behaved themselves, so everything was very cool. And essentially, what can I say? It was less of a protest and almost more of, I don't know. I haven't even really thought this through. If any of you were there, you tell me what you thought. Like, when I went to New York on February 15th, 2003, to say, don't attack Iraq, and tens of millions of us did the same thing, This was angry. We knew that Bush lied about weapons of mass destruction. We knew that Bush lied about any connection between Saddam Hussein and the events of September 11th. And we knew that he was bound and determined with long-held plans to attack Iraq. It was all about oil. It was all about military bases and all that. Now, we were pretty angry because we knew that in spite of the fact that we knew this stuff, that and that we knew that Bush lied, that this was going to go ahead. Well, tens of thousands of dead people later, Americans and Iraqis, the majority of people now realize this. Well, they realize it through the persistence of the anti-war movement, the persistence of the people that were critics of Bush Co., Bush Incorporated, or the BCF, the Bush crime family, as some people call it. And it took physical form, partially at the ballot box, but most usually with rallies, demonstrations, town hall meetings, you name it, the internet, all of this. So this does work. This does work. This is, in fact, a way to move forward in a society that's becoming less and less democratic all the time, more and more elite controlled. And got a story here that Bush now, this is come totally under the radar. I hadn't even meant to talk about this now. I don't know if I can put my hand on it real quickly. But Bush has announced that he does not have to follow 750 laws that Congress has passed if he determines that it erodes his constitutional power as president. This has never happened before. Did you see the cover of Rolling Stone magazine, the magazine of rock and roll? It says that that Bush is the worst president ever. And the worst president ever is saying he doesn't have to obey 750 laws. So we are no longer a nation of laws. We no longer have a balance of power. We have one-man rule. And remember that Bush said this four separate times in the early part of his presidency, that his favorite form of government is one-man rule or dictatorship. And then he'd laugh. Well, this guy isn't laughing. And yeah, fascism doesn't particularly, or a dictatorship or an authoritarian government, doesn't necessarily come like the Nazis or something like that. I mean, they might even, hey, what the hell? Let Werby get on the air and talk. Let other people get on the air and talk. Because ultimately, though, if he has the power, why not? It gives the appearance of democracy. Well, one of the chants is, what does democracy look like? And then people chant back, this is what democracy looks like. And you think, well, wait a minute. I thought democracy was about voting. Well, what democracy is really about is that old slogan from the 1960s, let the people decide. That when you hear that phrase populist, remember it's now usually just put on Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. But a populist, remember, supports the rights and power of the people. The rights and power of the people. And isn't that what democracy is supposed to be all about? The corporatist, the people that think that the corporation should rule, that elite should rule, well, that's not democratic. That's the opposite of that. All right, so about 300,000 of us in New York City. Man, what a place. I mean, that place now, it was kind of crazy 15, 16 years ago in the 80s, but that it appears to run. At least the parts where I mean, there's still a lot of poor people, a lot of problems, but crime isn't real bad, very clean, subways are clean and safe, and wow, and there's what, 8 million people there, and they're expecting it will go up to 10 million. By the way, one of the things, as usual, in these anti-war demonstrations is the presence of vets, Iraqi vets, Vietnam vets, older guys, of course, and I don't know. I don't remember seeing any active duty Iraqi soldiers. There may have been, though. Oftentimes they'll have contingents of it. So if you were there, if you were in New York City along with me and 300,000 others saying, bring the troops home now, give me a call here on Night Call, 313-298-WRIF. Also, thousands of people joined celebrities and lawmakers at a rally Sunday urging the Bush administration and Congress to help end genocide in Sudan's Darfur region. Not on our watch, the crowd chanted as a parade of speakers lined up for their turn on a stage on the National Mall, the Capitol serving as a backdrop. So again, This is not a contentious issue. The war isn't really a contentious issue. There's the only people that still support Bush's war and occupation of Iraq who doesn't believe that he lied about everything in it, and the thing is an absolute total 100% disaster. This is not like that. I mean, is there anybody that thinks there should be genocide should continue in Darfur? Well, all of a sudden, you know, all the politicians, Bush, oh, I support this one. You know, I'm there with it. Yeah. And Condoleezza Rice as well. You know, we're trying to do something and all that. Didn't indicate what, though. All right. So let's go back to the contentious. Let me practice my terrible Spanish. Tomorrow, Monday, May 1st, May Day. Un día sin inmigrantes, un día sin inmigrantes, which means a day without immigrants. And what's going on is pro-immigration activists say a national boycott and marches planned for tomorrow, May 1st, will flood America's streets with millions of Latinos to demand amnesty for illegal immigrants and shake the ground under Congress as it debates reform. Now, it's also going to include smatterings of other people, Arab Americans or Arab immigrants in this area in Detroit and in New York. There's going to be Caribbean and Latin American people, I guess it's Latino, isn't it? But Caribbean and also some Polish, Russian, Irish, some here illegally. Here is what Jorge Rodriguez said. There will be 2 to 3 million people hitting the streets in Los Angeles alone. We're going to close down Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, Tucson, Phoenix, Fresno. He's a union official who helped organize earlier rallies, credited with rattling Congress as it weighs the issue. So this works. So right now we have our option. We can watch all of this, the war, Darfur, immigrants, and we can watch it all happen as spectators. Well, as spectators, you're going to get a pretty weak view of it all. For one thing, how many of you even knew that 300,000 people marched down Broadway in New York City yesterday, chanting, "Bring the troops home now"? Well, probably not very many of you, unless you're kind of in this scene, because the mainstream corporate media doesn't report it. It just doesn't report it. Even the New York Times, the paper of record in New York, they have a separate metro section other than the one that comes here, and they had it on page 3 of their inside metro section. So the other thing is you can take part in this. It's going to be a rally at Detroit's Clark Park in support of immigrant rights. And if you're stewing out there, you think, immigrant rights, what are they taking our jobs? What are they doing here? They're illegal. Send them all back. I mean, chill out. This problem has to be resolved. And it's not as easy as strong enforcement and strong borders. It's not as easy as send them all back. It's not even as easy as make them all citizens or anything like that. The whole problem is terribly complex. And it has to do with the economic relationships between our country and Mexico and the countries south of that in South America, Central and South America. And what has gone on historically over the years? I mean, why is there a line or the Rio Grande? And beneath that, good wages, below it, bad wages. What's going on here? What would you do? I mean, people are always saying, you know, these conservatives, they say, well, if there's no jobs here, why don't you go somewhere else? They do, right? They're these people that lack absolute compassion. They will say, if they can't find jobs here, they're not talking about immigrants. You're talking about you and me. If we get laid off, they're saying, well, what are they just on unemployment? Why don't they go somewhere else where the jobs are? That's capitalism, right? These people are refugees from a sector of capitalism that doesn't work, where because of things like the North American Free Trade Association, NAFTA, has destroyed farms destroyed the communities in numerous agriculture areas of Mexico. And then people can go into Mexico City with 21, 22 million other people. Let me ask, was that Paul? I'm asking Norma, our phone screener, was that, and you can write on that, was that from like London, England or London, Ontario? Huh? Because he's gone now. Maybe, well, all right. So it's, so this is going to happen. And if you want to take part in it, I'm going to go, and they want everyone to wear white. I can't even remember why. Let me see if I have it. But it's also called El Gran Paro Americano, the Great American Boycott 2006. And, it doesn't say why to wear white. But here, this was an email that I got on April 10th. And I don't even, it's from a former Michigan resident, and he and I had an email exchange, a nice one, and he said he withdrew this, but this is common sentiment. He says, I'm sending you an email in reference to immigration. I read at MSNBC that May 1st, all immigrants are going to walk out on their jobs and not buy consumer products for 24 hours. So my mom and friends have decided that if they're not going to buy consumer products that day, then we should double up on everything we buy for that day. Let's keep our economy going. Now, I would suspect that the vast majority of us listening here to Night Call are not immigrants. And so what interest do we have in all of this? What you know, maybe you'd say, well, that's a good idea. We, the good Americans, the good consumers, we're not going to take part in this. Well, first off, May 1st is International Workers' Day, and it's been, I'm not exactly sure when it began, but it commemorates an event that happened in 1886, where workers were striking for an eight-hour day, because people had to work like 10 hours then, and police shot them down. It's called the Haymarket Incident. The Haymarket Incident, or the Haymarket Affair, took place in Chicago. Someone never been found threw a bomb into a group of police. The cops then opened fire, shot their other police, but shot down workers. They tried, this is bad memory here, about five workers that had nothing to do with this but were organizers of the rally, hung a number of them, and sentenced a number of them to life imprisonment. Well, since then, May 1st, May Day, has been an International Workers' Day. So for those of us who aren't immigrants, of course, we all were immigrants at one time or another. One section of us came here unwillingly, as were brought here as slaves. But most of us of European extraction, particularly, we were immigrants at one time as well. So we ought to have some historic understanding and solidarity with people who are facing the same thing. And there was great discrimination against each group as well. Maybe not Anglo-Saxons, but against the Irish, certainly Eastern and Southern Europeans, against Jews, all of them, the Statue of Liberty, which I saw on Friday night. It says at the base, give me, you're tired, you're hungry. Well, when they got here, they weren't well thought of by all the immigrant groups that had already established themselves, particularly who they called the WASPs, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, mostly who traced their origins to the British Isles and Northern Europe. Anyway, so we ought to have some solidarity. But even if you don't have any solidarity whatsoever, we got a lot of problems here. We got a problem with a war. We have a problem with high gas prices. We have a problem with job creation that's going on, where the economy is going great guns, but average worker wages are dropping. So rather than for us, and if anybody's involved in organizing this immigrant stuff, they don't like this, you can call me as well, 313-298-WRIF. Rather than it being un día sin inmigrantes, a day without immigrants, why don't we make it un día sin todos? Todos, everyone, all of us. And why don't we extend this into a general strike? Because then we could probably achieve, and I don't know if I have this written here, I don't, but, you know, that line from V for Vendetta, from that film, that said, I think I'm saying it right, or something like this, people should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people. And right now we know the government is not afraid of us whatsoever. Increasingly, Bush rules by fiat. He says, I won't even enforce laws that I don't agree with. So we're talking, you say a dictatorship. Again, you think of Stalin or Hitler or somebody like that. But this is soft fascism. This is now not the rule of law, but the rule of one man. And this is a no better time than to do this. So I actually have to work tomorrow. Hey, there's no way I can not do this. And in fact, I don't want to talk about, and I wish no one would bring it up, why I have to. If you go to my website, peterwerbe.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com, W-E-R-B-E.com, you'll see why I have to work. But I'm not going to buy anything. Or I might buy gasoline at Citgo. Citgo is owned by the Venezuelan government, which instead of giving all of its profits to the swollen, obscene, ludicrous, greedy retirement packages like Lee Raymond, the ex-CEO of ExxonMobil, is getting $400 million, it all goes to the Venezuelan people, which is a lot better. Oh, yeah, I didn't say ITMFA. You can see what that means at my website as well. All right, so that's what I say. Un día sin todos, a day without us all. Let's put some fear into the hearts of this government. Let's put some fear into these huge corporations that think that they can just loot us endlessly, that they can increasingly take whatever they want from us, and we won't do anything. Because when someone like Lee Raymond, the ExxonMobil CEO, says, I'm going to get $400 million, and people say, wow, what a bad PR stunt. I mean, why couldn't they announce that some other time or done it in pieces? They don't care. They don't care. Nothing's going to happen. They can just spit in our faces, just shove us up against the wall, grab our wallets, take out the money, and, you know, we're not going to do anything. They don't think so. Maybe we'll vote for a Democrat in 2006, or maybe we'll vote for a Democrat in 2008. Now, nothing too great's going to change. Probably the worst of what's going on now may end. You may get somebody, a president, that'll agree to follow the laws that Congress has passed, and he's charged by the Constitution with enforcing. You may have somebody in there that won't lie about getting into wars and all that. But a lot of the overall configurations of the society we live in aren't going to change at all. Unless we make them happen, unless we change them. All right. So do I have time? I do. I'll just do this real quickly. Oil prices rise as IAEA finds Iran defiant. Well, what that means is that the International Atomic Energy Agency said that Iran has defied the UN Security Council by enriching uranium. Iran is OPEC, the oil group's second largest oil producer, has said that it seeks the technology only to generate nuclear power, but like the U.S. believes it wants to create weapons of mass destruction. And so as it is, April 28th, Friday, I think it may have dropped a little, $72.02, $72.02 a barrel. And so this is a very large problem, says Josh Bolton. He's the new chief of staff, who said the White House plans to address high gasoline prices and will only, but he says that it'll only have a modest impact, and the ultimate goal must be reducing dependence on foreign oil. Where the hell are we going to get it from? We've already hit peak production. We've already hit peak production in the United States. See, I mean, part of this is they want to repeal the environmental protections against this toxic source, oil. They want to be able to loot more of the environment by drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and all that. So they're going to blackmail us, they say. Well, we know you wanted to protect the environment, but do you want to pay $7 a gallon for gas? That's your two choices, buddy. $7 a gallon for gas, or we destroy Alaska. Your choice. All right. I want to take one call before we go, because it's a little bit of long distance. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Dean. Dean's in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, and he was at the New York demonstration. Hi, Dean.
Hello.
How you doing?
I am not bad. How are you?
Good, good. You traveled quite a ways.
Yeah, actually, I'm not quite home. I'm staying with relatives in Linden right now.
Linden, Michigan?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, what'd you think?
First major demonstration I ever went to, and I was actually kind of relieved. I was of the opinion that I was the only one in the UP who had a problem with Bush.
Well,
it turns out I wasn't.
How did you know that?
I don't know. Like I said, I'd been to demonstrations, but they were all in the Upper Peninsula, so it was relatively small scale compared to the mass amount of people that were in New York on Saturday.
Yeah, did you go on a bus, or how'd you get there?
No, I just drove myself. I found out about the demonstration through one of the organizations, the Peace Advocate organizations I get emails from, and I just drove down there myself.
Yikes, it's a long drive. Must be, about almost 1,000 miles.
Yeah, give or take.
Yeah.
I have friends in New Jersey, too, so I stopped and visited them as well.
That's good.
Spent the weekend with them.
Actually, my wife and I flew into New York on Wednesday and flew back today. But, man, prices.
Yeah.
I said to my wife, I said, you know, we spent a lot of money on this trip. Because it used to be you get, like, Spirit for, like, $135, and it's close to twice that now. So, I don't know. I mean, we had a good time and saw friends that live there, but... It got pricey. But you know what they did in Detroit? These people are probably sleeping. People left at 8 p.m. Friday, two busloads of Detroiters, and drove all night, got there at 8 a.m., and then stayed there till 8 p.m. Saturday, and then drove all night Saturday night, Sunday morning. Yow!
Actually, maybe I should have went with them. I don't have good connections as far as that sort of thing goes, I guess. But, it was still... really cool.
Congratulations.
I had a good time, and everybody was extremely nice, even the police, which surprised me.
Well, here, Dean, you got to check my website. My calendar had the bus stuff on it. Next time.
Okay.
All right. I'll see you at the next one.
All righty. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
WRIF.com.
WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. 313-298-WRIF. We're talking about a proposed Un Dia Sin Inmigrantes, a day without immigrants, but I'm suggesting that we have Un Dia Sin Todos, that we all stay at home tomorrow to the extent that we can. If we can't miss school, if we can't skip work, I mean, what the hell? It's going to be a beautiful day. And if you got to go to work, don't buy. Let's let the elites know we're out here. Let them know that we're not going to take it passively anymore, that we're going to do everything we can to regain popular control of our lives. Because right now they're being eroded. Political rights are being eroded. Our standard of living is being eroded. We're being more and more endangered by the mad foreign and war policies of the BCF, right? The Bush crime family. Anyways, who is this? This is Ian. Ian's listening in Windsor, Ontario, and he says, I just finished watching the funniest movie I've ever seen, Canadian Bacon. That's pretty cool. That was a Michael Moore film, maybe in the early 90s or something like that. It was a fictional deal. And well, here he says, the movie is roughly U.S. president has low approval rating, needs a war to improve his rating, so they make a false threat from Canada. And to make the U.S. public more fearful, the U.S. allows an insider to blow up a power plant. The movie has humor in it, but it's funny how close the movie is to Bush making his false war with Iraq and how he made the general public think there was a threat from Iraq. Was Bush watching the movie? Ian says, I think he was. So that's that part of it. I was saying earlier, by the way, that the people that are calling for the national immigrant boycott, I'm adding to that. We're going to do it for one way or the other. If you support immigrant rights, fine. But if not, it's over gasoline. It's over the war. It's over what's going on in this country. And Fernando writes in, as far as I know, white is widely considered the color of peace. This is why they ask us to wear white tomorrow. And I was saying earlier that is the color of the day. Wouldn't that be nice? You know, kind of, they have had all this, like, purple revolution, or what is it? Stuff like this could be the white revolution, that of peace. Now, pardon me, Robert writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. The whole immigration national anthem issue, which I'll talk about in a half a sec, sounds like a Karl Rove election tactic to fire up the Republican base, just like they did with Terry Schiavo and the gay marriage issues. America, don't be fooled again. After all, what's more offensive, saying the Lord's Prayer in Spanish or singing the national anthem in Spanish? I believe God is not offended, and neither should anyone else be. I personally couldn't give a damn. Dave from Dearborn writes in, love the show. Consider the idea that the issue of immigration was raised to turn our attention from other more relevant issues such as the war, high gas prices, and domestic spying. Well, certainly. And, you know, people have not really got real bent out of shape. I thought, oh, no, the white American, particularly the white American guys, are going to go bonkers. And they can say, they're doing, you know, Because, as I say, this is this country is run on the politics of resentment. So Bush says he opposes, well, he opposes the national immigration boycott. Gee, how weird that he would, huh? Bush opposes singing anthem in Spanish. I mean, I got to improve my Spanish. I mean, I've been to Cuba, I've been to Venezuela, and I'm just still like gringo supremo, if that's even the adjective. Bush said Friday the national anthem anthem should be sung in English, not Spanish, in a blunt rejection of a new Spanish language version. I'm not a supporter of boycotts. Bush made his comments at a Rose Garden news conference as a Spanish language version of the Star Spangled Banner hit the airwaves, featuring artists such as Wyclef Jean, hip hop star Pitbull, and Puerto Rican singers Carlos Ponce and Olga Tenon. It's called Nuestro Himno, Our Anthem. The Spanish version rewrites some of the English version. For instance, the second stanza says, "My people keep fighting. It's time to break the chains." Well, that's pretty good. I mean, hey, my people, that's all of us, right? I think people who want to be citizens of this country ought to learn English, and they ought to learn to sing the national anthem in English. They all will. Don't worry, Georgie. By the third generation, all immigrants know English perfectly. Usually the parents come over here and they say, you know, they keep in their own communities very, this is true with everybody throughout American history. And by the third generation, without going on a long thing about it, by the third generation, everyone knows the whole deal. But, wait a minute, there was one more thing. I got too much stuff here, as usual. But where were those letters? Anyways, a number of people saying, is this just a diversion? Yeah. Of course it is. This, I've been holding this since April 15th. Social issues top GOP pre-election agenda. So they're getting all ready to pull the wool over your eyes. Protection of marriage amendment, check. Anti-flag burning legislation, check. New abortion limits, check. Between now and the November elections, Republicans are penciling in plans to take action on social issues important to religious conservatives, the foundation of the GOP base, as they defend their congressional majority. In a year where an unpopular war in Iraq has helped drive Bush's approval ratings below 40%, I think it's about 32% now, core conservatives whose turnout in November is vital want assurance that they're not being taken for granted. Well, it's not just aimed at conservatives. It's aimed at you. And they want to rile you. They want to shake your cage. They want to make you feel you can't do anything about a war. You can't do anything about gas prices. You can't do anything about a president that says he doesn't have to obey the 750 laws that structures an economy that robs us of our tax dollars and rewards the ultra wealthy. But let's get those gays. Let's stop flag burning. Well, but there is no flag burning. In fact, there will be if they pass legislation. And, you can't let those people go around having abortions. So that's what they're going to, that's the wool they're going to try to pull over your eyes. So watch it. That's my advice. All right. I don't see a next up here, so I'm going to take the person that is waiting the longest or let me see, maybe the farthest away. Now, we're going to go to Daryl in Detroit. Daryl, hi, it's Peter Werby, and you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? I have a question for you.
Sure.
And I'm kind of playing devil's advocate. You had made a comment earlier.
Wait a minute,
earlier.
Daryl. I am the devil's advocate.
Well,
just ask any of these right-wingers. Go ahead.
That may be true. However, there's an intelligent life form out there. Listen, you made a comment about the president earlier stating that he was lying to us when he made a statement or numerous statements about weapons of mass destruction. Do you recall that?
Sure.
So my question is, there are people in the media who have said that, not just yourself. We've heard it from various sources.
Right.
And I just want to know, like, how do we know that, or how do you know when you say that you sound convinced that the president of the United States was actually lying? I'm a Republican. I'm not crazy about the war, but I try to look at things with an open mind and look at the big picture. How do we know that the president...
How do we know he was lying? Well, I mean, it's becoming clearer and clearer with more and more exposures of everything from what's called the Downing Street memo, where it was, where they say that the policy was, the intelligence was to be fixed around the policy. We know that every bit of intelligence that was put forth from the weapons or from the nuclear program to these unmanned drones to these huge storage dumps of poison gases and elements like that was all manufactured often by informants who had a vested interest in getting this information to U.S. intelligence sources. And every step of the way, the president's office or the vice president's office was warned that this stuff wasn't credible. This is coming out more and more. But it's pretty clear that there was an intention to go to war as a way to finally do what these conservatives had planned all along through this project for a new American century. That in this, as we see developing around oil, the need to control access to this growing precious substance of oil got to be a priority of this, essentially a cabal of neocons. And they acted on it. How did I know? Well, let me ask you that. How did I know so well that there were no weapons of mass destruction? You thought there were, right?
Well, I can't say there was. I can't say there wasn't.
Well,
I mean,
Darryl,
I live here in the great country of America.
Well, I do too. But Darryl, we spent tens of millions of dollars once the United States invaded and occupied Iraq trying to find anything, the barest evidence that there were something, at least to suggest that there was a program, that there had been something there at one time or something like that. And finally, George W. Bush, how about that for a source, said, no, you know, there's nothing. And he also said there's no connection between al-Qaeda and what happened on September 11th, even though Cheney kept at this and to some extent that he still is. And in a way that Bush does... as well. I mean, these guys are liars. They attempted to deceive the American people with the most blatant lies, and had such arrogance based on their power, their wealth, and their contempt for the democratic process that they just thought that they could say and do anything. They thought they'd march in there. I mean, what do you do when the liars lie to themselves? So they really thought they could just march right in there, take it all over there, build half a billion dollar embassy, start pumping the oil to pay for the war, and they'd be throwing flowers at our soldiers' feet. Well, I sat here in this radio station, this program, and said, these guys are mad. And anybody with, I'm sorry to say it, anybody, well, I don't want to say with half a brain, because most people didn't pay enough attention. But I'm the only person that knew this. It was easy to know they were lying. All right. Thank you. Appreciate it. Let me see here. Here is Jason. Jason's in Hazel Park. Hey, Jason, you're on the air. Hi.
Hey, Peter. How you doing tonight?
Doing good.
I wrote you last week about an email about attending the rally in New York City with three of my friends, and we went with the McCauley group.
Oh, yeah.
Got back on the bus early this morning. It was a heck of a trip, but it was well worth it. I just want everyone to know that if you've never been anything like this, you need to go. You need to drag your friends, do whatever you need to do to go. The people we went with were the nicest, kindest people you'll ever meet, and they were from every sect of religion, gender, you name it, they were there. And they would have given the shirt off your back to you if you needed it. So
I saw some of them at Foley Square, the terminus of the march. And some of them, of course, were these faith-based people, particularly these Catholic peace activists who are in their 70s and all that. I'm thinking, man.
Oh, yeah. We were with people on the bus that were in their 70s and 80s, and I was uncomfortable. And I'm 27. I'm going, wow, I can't believe it. You know, people like that really inspire me as a young person in this country to say, hey, you know, I got to do something. So I dragged my friends, and they had the best time, and they'd never been anything like this. And I've been to some of the stuff in Detroit and events like that, but nothing this major rally. And I'd never been in New York before, so it was good to get out and see it and be there with a purpose. So, yeah, just to let everyone know, you need to step up and let your voice be heard.
Well, Jason, I've been probably in New York 20 times easily. In fact, at one point, my parents even lived there. And I've been there quite a few times, but it's always staggering. I can't believe that that it exists in the population concentration. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to sound like a real hick, but those mighty big buildings, aren't they? Speaking of mighty big buildings, you were probably walking distance to the World Trade Center. Did you get?
We went the other way. We went to Times Square, and we actually went got something to eat at Chinatown. So it was we kind of made a heck of a little trip out of it, but. I'm tired. I'll tell you that. I'm really tired, but I'm glad I went.
You'll hate me. I don't know if you heard me earlier. I flew in, flew back. But, where did you eat in Chinatown? We were on Mott Street, and we ate at the new Big Wang restaurant.
It was something like that. Like Boy Bop or something. I don't remember the name of it, but it was good. And it was $4, so it was very, you can't beat it.
Wait, yeah, you beat mine. Mine was $5. All right, Jason.
It was great. Hey, Peter, talk to you.
I'll see you at the next one.
Will do.
Bye now. Well, let me do this. I'm going to stay on the line if you're holding on, because if not, I'll have to give you just a real short call. Also, when we come back, I want to play this song by Pink, which I never could imagine playing. But she has this incredible song. She sings it live on this version we have, along with the Indigo Girls. And it's very, very incredibly striking. It's called Dear Mr. President. It's on my website, by the way, as is. Oh, I forgot, I should tell you that, too. The entire Neil Young new album that includes the song Impeach the President. That's a new Neil Young album called Living with War. Yeah, right. I believe it is. It's all off the top of my head. But go to my website, Peter Werbe, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E, W-E-R-B-E. You can hear the Pink song, see the video. It's very dramatic. And Pink always looked pretty harsh, pop singer. But, man, she looks like Marilyn Monroe. It's really bizarre. And the Neil Young album is there. And I wanted to download Impeach the President, play it for you. I wonder if that's going to, be a big hit, be played on commercial radio. But anyway, you got to play the whole album in sequence. You can't, at least I haven't figured out how to download it, and I just got back from New York a little while ago. But I will be right back and take your calls, 313-298-WRIF, and do a little Pink.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220. This is WRIF.com.
Make up your mind. Decide to walk with me around the lake tonight. Around the lake tonight, by my side. By my side. I'm not gonna lie. I'll not be a gentleman.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thanks a lot. Welcome back. 313-298-WRIF. Another hour of your calls and then a couple of interviews. But right now I'd like to play this song. It's on my website. You can, the visual's really great. It's very moving. Although it's just Pink, the pop singer, and the Indigo Girls sitting on a stage accompanied by a single guitar. So it doesn't rock out like maybe a lot of us expect here on WRIF, but I think it's pretty powerful. So this is Pink and the Indigo Girls live on WRIF. Dear Mr. President, name of it.
One of the most important songs I've ever written is called Dear Mr. President, and we're going to play it for you. Mr. President, come take a walk with me. Let's pretend we're just two people and you're not better than me. I'd like to ask you some questions if we can speak honestly. What do you feel when you see all the homeless on the street? Who do you pray for at night before you go to sleep? What do you feel when you look in the mirror? Are you proud? Mother has no chance to say goodbye. How do you walk with your head held high? Can you even look me in the eye and tell me why? Mr. President, were you a lonely boy? Are you a lonely boy? How can you say no child is left behind? We're not dumb and we're not blind. They're all sitting in your cells while you pave the road to hell. What kind of father would take his own daughter's rights away? And what kind of father might hate his own daughter if she were gay? I can only imagine what the First Lady has to say. You've come a long way from whiskey and cocaine. How do you dream when a mother friends. You'd never take a walk with me. Would you?
That's Pink on Night Call WRIF radio station. You're listening to. It's a talk show. Call in 313-298-WRIF. Well, that was a particularly powerful song. If you'd like to see the video that accompanies it, it's pretty striking as well. You go to my website, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E. And let's get back to our phone. Some open lines for you if you want. Here's John in, from Farmington Hills. John, hi. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Peter, it's great to talk to you. I listen to you all the time, and personally, I think you should run for president.
Wow.
Seriously, because I just want to know some ways people can get involved to get these crooks out of office. Because, I mean, these people should be being taken away in handcuffs.
Yeah, they
and
should.
I mean, you look at the gas prices, you look at everything. One organization, maybe, you know, a lot of people might say he's crazy or he's nuts, is Lyndon LaRouche. He's really getting the Democrats together. He's got a lot of followers, a lot of people. Some people might say this, that, but he speaks a lot of truth, whether you think he's crazy or whatever happened, you know, back in the Bush administration with Bush's father. But, you know, people need to get involved. And I just, you know, wanted to ask you, if there's some websites out there. How do people get involved? Because that's the problem. People want to be involved, but they don't know how to get involved because this nonsense.
Well, I got you, Johnny. I mean, here, one of the things, I'm always sending people to my website, but I don't get anything out of it. I just have it there as a resource. If you go there, eventually everything that I think is a good source of information is there. Like, you can go on the right side of it, and there's all these the websites that I go to find out things every day. Why I didn't get fooled by Bush Co. And you go to the left side, for instance, and there is a calendar. Not much on it now. Hey, in fact, people, you can send me calendar items at calltalkyes@yahoo.com as well as messages. And that's how you start hooking up with these different movements that are working for change. So that's a good way to start. And then one thing leads to another. And you might say, well, it's okay, you know, it's a good start over on Werbe's site. But, man, I found something else, a link to that. So give it a shot. All right, thank you, John. Now, this guy, man, it's you know, if you literally have to laugh or you would cry about what's going on in this country. They're changing the chairs on the Titanic, right on in the Bush White House. So now they got this guy named Josh Bolton, and he's the White House chief of staff. And here's his latest deal. He says that it's time for the White House to go on the offense and, quote, get our mojo back. these conservative frat rats, these ultimate white boys talking about getting our mojo back. I mean, it's so pathetic. It just, I just can't even begin to tell you what. Now, this is Josh Bolton, and Bush has nicknames for everyone. Another sign of this arrogance. He gives everyone nicknames. No one gives him nicknames, you know. They would, what was like the seven dwarfs? What would he be? Dopey. Right? No one say, hey, dopey. He calls Josh Bolton Yash. So it's not like Yash can say, yeah, dopey, what do you want? But anyways, Bolton, this is an AP account. Bolton, who said Bush calls him Yash and several other unrepeatable nicknames. And then it goes on for some. So Bush has like obscene nicknames for his chief of staff. I mean, think about that. I mean, think about, I don't even know how to pose this. These guys are so weird. I mean, they're the weirdest characters that have ever come to the surface, right? What, remember the melting pot deal? The scum rises to the top and those on the bottom get burned. Here, I finally found this article. You can go to boston.com. Bush challenges hundreds of laws. President cites powers of his office. Bush has quietly claimed the authority to disobey more than 750 laws enacted since he took office, assuming that he has the power to set aside any statute passed by Congress. You know, this is only what the autocrats of Europe did. They would have these kind of weak parliaments, but the king said he wouldn't be bound by it. And I don't know why this doesn't, here's more. I mean, high crimes and misdemeanors. Why would we call Bush the Bush crime family, the BCF? I mean, this is another. I mean, this is enough. This is enough of the challenge of the system of checks and balances to get rid of this guy. All right. Yash. But this is what Bush calls his new chief of staff. Yash and other unrepeatable names. He says that Bush's plans to address high gasoline prices will only have a modest impact. And it's a large problem. It's built up over the many years, decades. Well, who's it been a problem for? It hasn't been a problem for the oil companies. It hasn't been a problem for Lee Raymond, who's got a $400 million retirement package. It hasn't been, let me see if I got these stats here, too. Is it in my economy? Oh, yeah. You know, it's on. Sometimes I have this way of bundling things together. U.S. economy still expanding at rapid pace. So things are going great, right? Talk about all these jobs, created 300,000 jobs. Most of them don't pay dick, though, right? Chevron first quarter earnings soar 49% to $4 billion, right? Oppenheimer and company analyst Fadel Geit said, all these companies have so much money, they don't know what to do with it. Are you ready for that? All these companies, he's talking about ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and Chevron. They have so much money, this Wall Street analyst says. So this is somebody who's sympathetic to them. They have so much money, they don't know what to do with it. How about this for a suggestion? Charge us lower prices. That's what they know what to do with it. They distribute it among themselves. So this guy, the CEO, Lee Raymond, who's presided over this highway robbery, a man who should be in jail for fraud. What is it called? It's something like theft by trick. There's some law like that or something. I think that could be it. Theft by trick. He should be in prison for that, for stealing the money out of our pockets. Instead, he's being honored with this $400 million retirement package. And that's because the companies have so much money, they don't know what to do with it. I mean, you think, well, wait a minute, don't the stockholders want that distributed among themselves? I mean, it's a pittance compared to what they've looted us of. Exxon quarterly profit, fifth highest ever. Ooh, they're not doing so well. But it turns out they're not doing so well because of something else didn't happen. Oh, yeah. Its earnings came in below its record fourth quarter because all three of its businesses, exploration and production, refining and chemicals, didn't perform as well. Now, here's a nice little article because they're waiting to see what we do. We don't do much. That's why I'm saying let's join the immigrants and the immigrant supporters tomorrow with a general strike. No work, no school, no buying. You got to go to work. I got to go to work tomorrow. I can't get out of it. No way I can get out of it. When you're broadcasting, you got to be there. School might be tough, you know, parents or something like that, but then don't buy. Let's show some clout because doing it all together means we have some power. It actually might make the corporations and the government a little fearful of us. They might have to take us into consideration when they make war or they raise prices or they destroy our rights or they refuse to follow the Constitution and all the high crimes and misdemeanors that the BCF continues to perpetrate on a regular basis. So I just looked, the gasoline corner where I came from just now went down, went like 272. New York, I think it was about 315 a gallon. But that's based on Friday, it was $72 a gallon. May have gone down. But the growing here, this is according to the London Observer, I won't even tell you the headline. The growing international crisis over Iran's nuclear program could trigger a catastrophic oil price spike, sending crude prices over $100 a barrel, senior Wall Street analysts are warning. Now, I thought about this. One of the ways, I mean, some of these countries like Kuwait or these Emirates are just sort of oil companies with a flag. And countries like Saudi Arabia, they've got so much wealth, they don't even know what to do with it. But there's a number of countries that have still grinding poverty in them, like Venezuela and Iran. So what's happened here? It isn't that there's been this shortage of crude oil. A lot of this is based on futures. I mean, what they think, because they can go, wow, will Iran not send us oil? Will Nigeria melt down? Will Hugo Chavez do something? You know, they don't know. So that sends the future price of it, the futures, up higher. So I was thinking maybe Iran is doing this as a way of a little payback for all the years of colonialism, imperialism, of overthrowing the Iranian government in 1953 and setting up this hideous dictatorship that was a pal of the United States, a torture state. And that's why they hate us. That's why they got a Jones on us, right? Now, Chavez of Venezuela, he wants to peg oil at $50 a barrel permanently so that it would be impervious to the market. And you'd just have to ride with it. He says, though, that it's not a low price, but it's a fair price. He says, we have the largest oil reserves in the country in Venezuela. We have oil for 200 years. $50 a barrel, that's a fair price, not a high price, he says. All right. So I don't know what's other than that, I'm not sure what is what's possible. But if we don't intervene directly as citizens, history is going to be made for us. So we're either going to be the objects of history, and that's what the BCF hopes, that they can manipulate us through our fears of terrorism, of gays, of flag burning, of abortion, stuff that you know we may care about, but isn't about the policy that they really care about. They care solely about looting the American public and shifting more and more wealth to the people that are already wealthy and don't need it. So they're psychos. They're freaks. They're quite mad. And they have us in their control. And they're not afraid of us. And we're greatly afraid of them. So we got to change this equation. We've got to make them afraid of us. Or we're screwed. It's quite that simple. Never did get around to talking about that gas bag hypocrite, Rush Limbaugh, who... I'll tell you about that in a minute. All right. Here's Ed. Ed's in Toledo. Ed, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
You mean you were getting ready to talk about hash feedball?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing that, you know, if you're a windbag for the neocons, you just get off with a slap on the wrist. But if you're, you know, happen to be some poor minority, you end up doing a mandatory minimum.
Yeah, or like my buddy who wasn't a poor minority who was doing 21 years in jail, has already done 16 and said, well, next five will be easy.
Yeah, no doubt. I like that song, Pink. I never really heard of her. And I've heard of the Indigo Gals, but never heard of Pink. I'm pretty much bluegrass, Allman Brothers kind of, you know, meat and potatoes kind of music lover.
That had kind of a slightly country sound to it, didn't it?
Yeah. Kind of a more Americana roots,
yeah,
alt country kind of sound. That's, you know, I like getting the alt country too, because I don't, to me, the Toby Keith country, I call it corporate country. And
sure.
It's, you know, it's just disco to me. But
you know, the Dixie chick, what's her name, Maines, what's her first name?
Yeah, Natalie.
Natalie Maines, yeah, she was, I don't know if she still does, but in concert, after all that hassle about them occurred, she was, she had a thing she had on her, let's see, it said F, I gotta make sure that F-U-T-K.
Yeah.
Yeah. Figure that one out.
Yeah, you know, the more I listen to you and the more, you know, I check out other alternative websites, you know, I'm more afraid of the smirking chimp and the BCF, the Bush crime family,
yeah,
than I am afraid of the illegal aliens or the gays or the, or, you know, any of the other so-called, you know, enemies of the state. Because,
well, all the rest of the immigration and what happens to a country when you have a flood of people into it is a problem and should be dealt with. And so, but it's nothing that should be feared. It's something that should be dealt with. The other stuff we may have, I mean, someone may be anti-abortion and despise the thought of the national symbol being burned, and what was the third thing that they were on about? I don't know, whatever. But what people should realize that they're trying to manipulate them to jerk their chains in order to have them support their, ultimately, not support, at the same time, they'll wind up supporting their financial policies that just robs that person that's, say, anti-abortion, that robs him and his family all the more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, you know, I'm not gay, but, you know, if two gals want to get married or two guys want to get married, it has no effect on me whatsoever.
What do I care?
I'm still going to wake up and put my tennis shoes on like I did this morning.
I got it. Thank you, Ed. I appreciate it. Here from USA Today, 39 million reasons why $3 gas may change America. Just how big a deal is $3 gasoline? For those with six-figure household income, it's an annoyance, but a little more. Evian spring water goes for about $6.80 a gallon when purchased in one-liter bottles. For those in the tap water brackets, the situation is a bit different. For many of the 39 million households making less than $30,000 a year, the difference between $2 gas and $3 gas is the difference between spending 10% of income on gas and 15%. In a word, ouch, says USA Today. So that's who's really being hurt. And you know, the figures, U.S. figures, that if you make under $19,500, then you're poor. If you make $20,000 a year, you're not poor. Let me say this. People don't like to be called poor, even if they are, because it sort of assumes that there's some personal failing there, whereas it's built in. I mean, no matter what happens, there's always going to be there's been more and more poor people, but there's going to be a rich class, the ruling class, the elite class that represents a teeny-weeny minority of us that controls and owns virtually everything, most of everything in terms of wealth, and all important wealth, all wealth that controls our lives. Then you have a middle class, you have a working class, and then you have the poor. I would say that if you're making $30,000 a year and you have a family, you're finding life pretty difficult. You might not want to be called poor, but think of this. Richest country in the world, and there's 39 million families, not people. 39 million households. Maybe if it's households, it could can be one-person households, I guess. But it's obviously larger ones as well. I mean, this is a crime in and of itself. It really is. And so there's a support in Congress for an excess profits tax. So if these folks are going to rip us off, it ought to come back and do something worthwhile with it, rather than just lining. It doesn't even line the pockets. You can't line your pockets with $400 million the way the CEO has. You'd fall over. So this H.R. Bill 2070 instituted excessive profit tax on gasoline and diesel, transferred the revenue from the excessive profits tax to Americans who would buy ultra-efficient cars made in America with a tax credit, and establish a broad-based, far-reaching program to promote mass rail transit inter- and intra-city. We used to have that, by the way. We used to have that. And virtually a conspiracy destroyed all of it. All right. Let's take some more calls. Hey, have a little patience. My Lord. I'm yakking on tonight. I realize that. But stay on the phone. 313-298-WRI. Here's Tim. Tim's in Romeo. Tim, you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing well, thanks.
I like the one guy that called and he says, what can we do about it?
Okay.
I talk to 1,000 people every week. They say the same thing, whether it be the war, immigration, gasoline. Let's just take care of gasoline real quick. I'll say to you people now, in my area, Shelby, Sterling Heights, Clinton Township, Macomb Township, I got Troy, Oakland Township, Romeo, Bruce Township. I'm trying to organize 10 different townships, get the people together. We're going to file a class action lawsuit against the oil companies.
Wow, that's great.
And I suggest that everybody else in Michigan get off your butts. Don't wait for the politicians to do it. Every time I call up a township supervisor, they tell me the same thing. Well, let's wait for the senators, the state senators to do it. Or the state, they're not going to do it, folks. They're not going to do it for you. You have to do it. You pull your money together, you get your lawyers together, and we'll get these frickin' oil companies in court, and I guarantee you, you'll prove that they formed a cartel. They're controlling the price, the flow of oil. I will guarantee you, and I'm willing to open my mouth. I talked to a lawyer the other day. He was frightened to take the case. He said, they'll send somebody out and kill me.
Yeah, well, you know what, Tim, one of the things you ought to do, so you're not reinventing the wheel. I mean, this may be already going on in other parts of the country and with other groups. There's one that does a lot of litigation like that called publiccitizen.org. Wait a minute. I think it's just citizen.org. The group's called Public Citizen, the one that was established by Ralph Nader. And check that out, because, yeah, let's give them hell on all fronts. I mean, I'm not trying to say that the only thing to do, I'm always talking about demonstrations and direct action. Direct action gets you satisfaction. Well, it also, everything from pray-ins to voting and lawsuits and all that, that all can be a piece of it. Writing letters to the editor, all of that can. But let's have a boycott tomorrow. That's another thing. Hey, I was talking earlier about the having a general strike that all of us, not just immigrants, but all of us, and don't buy any gasoline tomorrow except from Citgo. All the profits from Citgo go to the people of Venezuela, the poor people of Venezuela. None of it is going to go to some retirement fund for some ultra-wealthy guy making hundreds of millions of dollars a year. All right. Thanks a lot, Tim. Keep me informed about what's going on. It's very, very interesting, and we'll be right back.
Got a buck? Get a song.
Can I get a holla, holla?
Log on to WRIF.com and check out the digital music store. Any riff song is available for just 99 cents online. Browse by artist, title, or riff playlist. Easy and cheap. The Riff Digital Music Store at WRIF.com. Everything.
Get into it.
That rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thanks a lot. 313-298-WRIF. This is our last segment, and then we'll go into our recorded interviews that I did earlier in the week. In fact, I did them before I went to New York City for the big 300,000-person anti-war demonstration. And for the life of me, I can't remember who they're with. I got to have them listed which one I want to... how come I... Let me see. No, can't do it. Cannot bring it up. All right. Before, stay on the line. If you're, most of you want to talk about oil profits, but I just want to talk about this gas bag, this horrible person. I hate even to ever mention right-wingers' names because it just gives them publicity. Yeah, but, I mean, he's such a public figure. So Rush Limbaugh has, after 3 years under suspicion, he's finally put behind him the investigation that exposed the conservative commentator's own drug problems, thrusting him into the spotlight for the very things he derided in others. He mocked the death of Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead, for instance. And many of you know that he said that drug users ought to be put away. So I thought it would be interesting irony to put him in the slammer, although ultimately I don't think he or anyone else should be put in jail for drugs. Absolutely insane. You want to change your consciousness, so they are going to put you in jail. So I am totally libertarian on this, think all drugs ought to be legalized. The duty of the government is to inform the citizenry about dangers and to educate people of the harm that can come from misuse. What do we do about food, right? Feed all McDonald's, like in that, what was that called, Supersize Me? You get bad effects. Well, if you do a lot of cocaine or if you do a lot of heroin, there's a real attendant problems. You shouldn't do it. It's not good. But most people know that anyways. So if you don't agree, they throw you in jail. And so, you know, we spend like $1 trillion. There goes our national health plan. There go our roads. There go our schools, trying to stop people from smoking flowers or, mixing up flowers and putting them in their veins. You know, it's up to the individual. But we ought to take care of our citizenry. And so that there ought to be mental health programs, community health programs, and deal this with, you know, people that can't control their uses, just like we do with alcohol or food for that matter, deal with it as a health problem and destroy the prison industrial complex. I mean, I don't even know. Some people think that if you made drugs legal, it could have such an awful effect on the economy. But anyway, that's a long, long discussion. Prosecutors seized Limbaugh's medical records after learning that he had gotten about 2,000 painkillers described by four doctors in 6 months. So this guy did 2,000 Oxycontins. I mean, how could he broadcast? Remember, I've always said, war on drugs? I can't even drive on drugs. I certainly couldn't do this broadcast. And he went deaf from using all this Oxycontin, and he had this system where they would have this voice program where it would turn it into a digital readout for him so he would see. I mean, I know this business. So I thought, man, the guy sounds weird. But he's deaf. He was stone deaf from using all this Oxycontin. How 2,000 painkillers? Man, what a stoner this guy was. All right, so he was doctor shopping. You go to four doctors in 6 months and you get 2,000 painkillers, you're doctor shopping. You're breaking the law. And according to his little formula, Rush Limbaugh's, he should have been in the slammer. But of course, because he's a multimillionaire, he's a friend of Bush Co. and all that, he walks, essentially. Let me tell you this, too. One right-winger, who I won't give any publicity to, she said that the left finally met a drug addict they didn't like. That's pretty cute and true. But the thing is, all the drug addicts I've known, all the people that have had problems with drugs that I've known, you think, oh, man, you just know a bunch of druggies. No, I mean, I know the people, most people I've known that have had problems with substance abuse have been alcoholics, and that, even in my family, probably in your family. I mean, who doesn't know an alcoholic or have a, know of somebody that is an alcoholic or something like that? Anyways, but he is such a hypocrite. I mean, he's the guy that celebrated Jerry Garcia's. He didn't celebrate, but it was like, what do you expect? But here, he hasn't changed either. He said, this is from the Drug Policy Alliance. You can go to drugpolicy.org. They're good folks. And I've interviewed, let me see, who's the head of this guy? Can't remember. Ethan Edelman, I think is his name. I can't find it. Anyway, for sale to the highest bidder should be the sign that hangs outside the Food and Drug Administration. From the emergency contraceptives to Vioxx, the agency is placing ideology and special interests above science. Now the FDA is providing cover to Congressman Mark Souter and others who want to put medical marijuana patients in prison. Because, you know, they issued this paper saying that there was no medical value. The Bush crime family. I mean, it's okay that they've got to recall these pharmaceuticals all the time, and no one's ever shown any problem with marijuana with medical effects. Maybe too much smoke, which isn't good. Anyway, first consider Rush Limbaugh's patient. Consider Rush Limbaugh's recent attack on cancer and AIDS patients. He said this on April 21st. Now here's a guy that's doctor shopping, that's popping OxyContin. And finally, because of his wealth, his privilege, his position in society, he gets off. Here's what he says about cancer and AIDS patients. The FDA says there's no, zilch, zero, nada, a shred of medicinal value to the evil weed marijuana. This is going to be a setback to the long-haired, maggot-infested, dope-smoking crowd. I mean, wouldn't you have liked to have seen this guy in the slammer? I mean, I can't justify it regardless, because nobody should go to jail for drugs. Mexico, by the way, has just passed a sweeping new drug law that you could have 25 milligrams of heroin, a fifth of an ounce of marijuana, or half a gram of cocaine. You could also possess small amounts of LSD, hallucinogenic mushrooms, amphetamines, and peyote. So this is all going to be legal in Mexico, and we're putting people in the slammer. Here is Matt. Matt is downriver. Matt, hi. You're on the air. Go ahead.
How you doing?
Good.
Man, 2,000 OxyContin.
Yeah.
What was that? That's a lot of prescription drug.
Yeah.
I'm not very educated on OxyContin, but I do know little from it, from like street value and stuff, you know, and. That sounds more like he's selling it and pushing it and getting rid of it than he's taking it, because that could kill somebody. Like, that's more terms of like killing yourself than of getting a high. I mean,
yeah, I almost wonder how he could do that much. But I mean, seriously, that's a big time downer. And how can you keep your wits about it? I mean, one of the things when you get to the level that he's at, he might even have script writers, because. When, like, it's me. I just do all this. I get my stories. I try to remember everything the best I can. Depend on some of you to set me straight if I make mistakes and what have you. But he has writers and researchers and what have you. So he might be running a lot of this off the top of his head. But, I've heard that when you get stoned, you might just be going, so President Bush, you just can't go anywhere with it. You just, because you're not supposed to, drugs, by the definition of it, aren't supposed to, like, increase your thinking. Some of it may, I guess. But I know, I agree with you. Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it. Let's go to Brittany. Brittany is across the river in Windsor. Thanks for making our program international, Brittany. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
I went to New York City on the bus this weekend with the Detroit Area Peace with Justice Network.
Yeah, so you were there with 300,000 of us.
Yeah, it was really great. I'm 16, and I've never been to anything like that before.
Mm-hmm.
Well, nothing that huge. So yeah, it was a really great experience.
Yeah, and your parents were cool with you going, I guess, huh?
Yep.
Yeah, that's good. And the bus, though, like I don't know if everybody heard earlier, but you left at 8 p.m., drove 12 hours. Ooh, did you get to sleep on the bus?
I got a few hours in.
Wow.
Not many, but I was just so excited that it didn't really matter, so.
Yeah, had you ever been to New York before?
I went once before, but it, you know, it's very different to see it in this light.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, one thing, it was nice. There was nobody disagreed with the 300,000 figure, and usually the newspapers and the police always say, oh, they'd say, oh, there's 20,000 people there. But I don't know if you got a chance. So we marched up Broadway from like 22nd Street, right? And when you, I don't know if you got a chance to look back, but it was as far as the eye could see.
Mm-hmm. That was amazing.
Yeah. And there was just anti-Bush and anti-war signs everywhere. I mean, throughout the city, even beyond just the, at the march.
Mm-hmm.
Well, good. I hope we don't have to go to any more. But besides it being important, besides, like I said before, that you are intervening in history in a positive way, it's a good experience, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's amazing. It's incredible. Mm-hmm.
I've been to a few, and I try never to miss them. I guess, though, I took the easy way. I flew there.
Yeah.
All right, Brittany. Thank you so much.
Okay.
I'll see you at the next one if we have to have another one.
Yep. I just wanted to say.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
In tomorrow being May Day, there's also a march in Windsor.
Yeah.
For people, and it's at 5 p.m. Whereas, you know, the one in Detroit is at 10 in the morning, so maybe more people can make that one. It's at the corner of Whelpton and Droulard.
Where is it again?
It's in Windsor at the corner of Droulard and Whelpton.
Okay. No, wait a minute. You know more than I do. When's the you said the one's 10 a.m. in Detroit, or?
Yeah, there's one in Detroit that's 10 a.m., and so I thought, like, people that are working might not be able to make that one, but then the one in Windsor is at 5 p.m.
Do you know where the one in Detroit is?
I'm not sure. I had an email about it, but.
Because I thought that there was one, I forgot even to announce it, at noon at Detroit's Clark Park. We'll check.
Yeah.
Thank you, Brittany. Thanks.
Okay.
Get out to that. International Workers' Day, May Day. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye. Yeah, May Day is, Labor Day is not the whatever it is in September. First Monday or Tuesday or Monday, isn't it now, or something like that. This is our holiday, working people's holiday, commemorating the Haymarket Affair of 1886. In fact, you can go to my website and you can, I think, it clicks on it. Also, it has the connection to the pagan holiday of Beltane, doesn't it? Where this is the period of renewal and spring and all that. So it's both joyous and also a commemoration of the gains that we've had to fight for over the last couple hundred years to not work 12 hours a day, have days off, to get double time, or I'm sorry, time and a half, or what do they call it? Overtime. That's the word I'm looking for. Overtime. Everything that we take for granted now has been brought about because working people had to fight for it from their employers. Because the employers, they could not care less about us at the origins. I mean, I know people that own companies, by the way, that try to do the best they can by the people that work for them. But they're the exception. Mostly we're thought of as an element of production, and they want to get us for as little as possible because the less they give us, the more they can get, right? They're involved in class struggle all the time. They are struggling for their class, the owning class, and particularly when you're talking about big capital. They have not only a class war against the classes below them, the middle class and the working class, but they also have intense class solidarity, something that we don't always have. So you get people that are ordinary working stiffs, and they're calling up and saying, well, you can't take away their money. They earned it. Lee Raymond earned his $400 million. I mean, this is astounding. They know what their best interests are. That's why they give millions of dollars to the Republicans and sometimes even to the Democrats, because they look after their interests. They understand that fully. They're fully cognizant of their class interests, and oh, be it that all of us would, because then their game would be over. All right. Let me let you talk for the rest of the hour. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Dennis. Dennis is in Detroit. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Pete.
Hi.
Hey, I have a comment about two things. First, corporate profits.
Okay.
And oil.
Sure.
Okay. I was watching a program on Detroit Public TV. about this automotive journalist, John McElroy, and he mentioned something about profit for the oil company.
Okay.
And he checked into it, and he said it was like only 9%. And he says, well, everybody's complaining about the oil companies. And he says, well, what about technology companies? He mentioned like Microsoft and another one. He says they're making like 25%.
Well, the energy companies have taken out these big ads showing that they're not making the highest profits and they're not getting the highest return on their investment. And it's the old thing of figures don't lie, but liars can figure, because they are having record profits. And so if they were making, say they wanted to make, I don't know what, 5% return on their investment, and but it would remain steady, because as their cost went up, they would move up the cost of the pump accordingly. But it's gone way up beyond that, so that they have these excess profits, and it only comes through price gouging. All right, thank you. I appreciate your question. Bob writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. What are immigrant rights? Do you mean rights for illegal aliens? Not sure what this rally is for tomorrow. Well, I have to say, I hate it when I have to say publicly, I don't know completely. For one thing, there's different strains within the immigrant community. The Catholic Church, by the way, is one of the big promoters of these rallies. A lot of their constituents are Catholics. And, something has to be altered of what's going on. I mean, and it's not that easy just to say, they should be guest workers, they should be given citizenship, they should all be rounded up and put in concentration camps, put on boxcars and sent back, or forced, as one Republican said. Sounds like, you know, Nazi slave labor. Rounded up, put in camps, and forced to build a wall. Right. Let's imagine that. I mean, that's good Republican suggested that. Someone said to me, what's the solution? The solution is you got to begin to equalize wealth between the countries. And so people will maintain the integrity of local communities and stay in Mexico, which I'm sure almost all of the people coming here would like to do. But the economy there has been ruined, and that's the problem that has to be addressed. All right, let's get some of these calls real quickly. Here is Alan in White Lake. Alan, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Are you with me? Yeah.
Not Alan, Josh.
Josh. Okay.
How you doing, Peter?
Okay, I see what's happened. I think we may have had the names reversed. Okay. But are you in White Lake?
No, Dexter.
Okay, this may be reversed then. All right, okay. You are Josh in Dexter. Do you want to? Yes. And you don't want to talk about gas prices. You want to talk about Iran?
Yes, sir.
All right.
There's just something I wanted to get your opinion on. It seems pretty concerning to me, and that is Bush keeps saying that he will stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons at any cost, okay? And then the White House, the House, passes unilateral sanctions against Iran. The White House comes out right afterwards and says, well, you're tying our hands diplomatically, okay? Well, the IAEA goes to Iran, does their inspections, and, of course, comes out and says, well, they're still enriching uranium. Then, the White House goes to the UN and says, well, we want sanctions. Of course, Russia and China oppose sanctions. And so it just seems like they're setting themselves up so that Bush can say, well, we have no other choice but then go bomb them.
That's certainly there's been a lot of that. I mean, including Seymour Hersh's article in The New Yorker. So they've got all... They've got the strike plans on the board, ready to go. But I don't know if they could pull this off. I mean, if they think that somehow bombing this other country, which would create this chaos in the region, would help them during the elections, which is really the only reason they would do that, because Bush went over and violated another treaty, which is the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, that India is violating by its nuclear program and its military nuclear program, and gave them the okay, gave them the go ahead, and so I mean there's not a bit of sense to it whatsoever. Let me just cut you a bit short because I want to get these last two calls in. Thanks, I appreciate it. Now I think we have Alan from White Lake. Alan, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Doing good.
This is coming from working class stiff that I work every day to make somebody else rich.
There you go.
This is the way I look at it. My boss is making $2 million a month for my $9 an hour.
Yikes.
I just got rid of a $30,000 conversion van that I bought for my family. I drive 100 miles every other weekend to see my son. I put 100 miles on my vehicle a day to go back and forth to work.
Yeah.
I couldn't afford to keep gassing. I'm now driving a $600 car that I bought for my little sister at that.
Hmm.
And just because of the gas mileage, don't get me wrong, I love this little convertible to death, but I'd rather have my van.
Sure. Well, by the way, too, I hope you realize, Alan, that your story is not unique at all.
And yeah. I know there's a lot of people out there like me that are suffering. And on the same hand, I raise my hand to every working stiff father out there and tell them, I know what it feels like to have half of a paycheck stolen from you every week for a child that you have to fight to see every time you turn around.
That's terrible. Just terrible. Listen, I want to talk to you more, but I got to get one more call. Thank you for your story. Call us again. We can talk more. Here is Stanley in Garden City. Stanley, hi. You're on the air. Hey, Stanley, you with me? Oh, I see. I got to press the button. Sorry. Now, Stanley, hi. You're on the air.
Oh, good evening. I thought the National Security Agency was dropping in on us from Bush.
No, I'm dropping the ball is what happened.
How you doing tonight, Peter?
Doing good.
I just had a question to ask you about our Energy Department secretary. I seen on Meet the Press this morning with Tim Russert. Did you have a chance to watch that?
I didn't. I was in New York. I was getting ready to fly back here. What's his name? Sam?
Put it this way. He's laughing about wanting to launch a nuclear strike against Iran. He had a panel of Democrats, Republicans, and hypocrites on there, as you do every Sunday, right?
Yeah.
But flip that. He's just laughing about it. Oh, yeah. We're going to do this and sanction them to death. And, you know, that's my first one. Second one, I watched 60 Minutes tonight, and Leslie Stahl has an issue of the U.S. Energy Department with Washington State with 53 million gallons of nuclear radioactive waste leaking underground in storage tanks. It's been there for 60 years, and they're faulty, and the contractors who made them were a company called Bechtel.
Sure.
They're contracted by our U.S. government.
Yeah, they make a fortune off of our tax dollars in Iraq building stuff that never gets built. Yeah.
Now listen to this. The groundwater is already contaminated, and it's moving toward the Columbia River, they said. And there's, you know, they took the money and ran, and it's just sitting there. The storage is still leaking into the ground. And
well, we got to go back to our caller right before you. That's what's happening in every aspect of the so-called economy, which really isn't an economy. It's a racket that fleeces the middle class and the working class, and the wealthier just get wealthier. Got to run, Stanley. Thank you. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned. Got a couple of great interviews. We'll talk live next week.
This is WRIM.com.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. And we've talked so much about Iraq and the whole idea of regime change, whether the United States has any right to do this, whether it needs United Nations sanctions, whether this is a break from what often is characterized as American reluctance to go into other countries to involve diplomacy in the United Nations whenever possible. Joining me is Stephen Kinzer. Stephen Kinzer is an award-winning foreign correspondent, and he's reported for more than 50 countries on four continents. And I remember him best from when he was head of the New York Times bureau chief in Nicaragua. He's also been bureau chief in Turkey and Germany. Before joining the Times, he was the Latin American correspondent for the Boston Globe. He has written numerous books, including All the Shah's Men, An American Coup, and the Roots of a Middle East Terror, and also co-authored Bitter Fruit, The Untold Story of the American Coup in Guatemala. He lives in Chicago. We're talking with him in New York City. Stephen Kinzer, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
It's great to be with you, Peter.
You know what I might do? Put a name to your book, which is Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. Now, I sort of just gave it away. There's a long tradition of this, isn't there?
Many Americans, and I think many people around the world, looked at President Bush's decision to invade Iraq as a moment when the United States was ripped away from its long tradition of cooperative diplomacy and thrust into a new era in which we violently set out to overthrow foreign governments. What I'm trying to do in my book is show that that isn't true. Actually, the United States has been overthrowing governments for more than 100 years. In my book, I try to look at each one of these cases. There are 14 of them over the period of the last 110 years. And for each of the 14 cases, I do three things. I ask three questions. The first thing is, what happened? I try to tell in a dramatic hour-by-hour way how we overthrew a particular government. The second question is, why did we do it? And the third question is, from the perspective of history, from the perspective of today, what has been the long-term effect of these operations? So by studying all 14 of them together, instead of looking at them as individual, isolated, unrelated incidents, certain patterns begin to become clear that I don't think are clear when you look at each of these episodes separately.
Well, Stephen Kinzer, as I said, I was most aware of you originally as a reporter in Nicaragua and dispatches you sent to the New York Times during the 1980s, and I was aware also that you've authored books. But usually when we talk about, when I interview people about foreign affairs, it's almost always academics. But you come to it with what's kind of the cliche, feet on the ground, in many ways, because you were certainly not back in Hawaii in 1893 or in Guatemala in 1954. But do you talk about Nicaragua during the 1980s?
As you said, I worked in Nicaragua during the 1980s, and I covered the Sandinista-Contra conflict there. I also covered the last part of the terrible civil war that devastated Guatemala. After covering these conflicts on a day-to-day basis over a long time, I began to think that I was missing something, that covering these stories just on the basis of what happened today or this week was not enough. I wanted to pull back and try to look at these operations in a larger context. Why is Nicaragua so poor and so constantly shaken by turmoil? Why is Guatemala in a violent, conflictive state? And that's what led me to write books about the American interventions in those countries that sent them off the path of development and into the path of conflict and poverty. Now, with my new book, I'm trying to do something even further. I'm thinking I didn't go far enough in my past books, because although those books were in-depth looks at individual overthrows of governments, they didn't tie all these governments together. And in many countries, as in Nicaragua and Guatemala, the United States overthrew a leader who embraced American principles and replaced him with a tyrant who despised everything the United States stands for. these kinds of interventions naturally produce terrible long-term effects.
Now, I suspect that there are at least some listeners that are sort of shocked by this and many incredulous. And why don't we start right from the beginning, like 1893, we have the Hawaiian Kingdom, and suddenly it becomes an American territory, and finally in 1959, an American state. Give us this story. This has always intrigued me.
I don't think many Americans realize at this point in our history that Hawaii was once an independent country. But it was. It was a monarchy. And the way it began moving towards its present status was in the early 19th century. A group of several hundred Protestant missionaries, most of them from New England, sailed out to what was then called the Sandwich Islands with the goal of, as they would have put it, raising up the heathen savages and teaching them the benefits of Christian civilization. It didn't take long before some of these missionaries and some of their sons began to realize that there was a lot of money to be made in Hawaii. The natives had been growing sugar for many years, but they had never refined it. They had never exported it. So a number of these white missionaries or descendants of missionaries began assembling large plantations by dispossessing native Hawaiians of their small landholdings. Pretty soon, there was a new, as they call it in Hawaii, missionary planter elite that controlled vast amounts of land and made a great fortune by exporting sugar to the United States. Now, in the early 1890s, this missionary planter elite was thrown into a panic because the United States had passed a tariff making it impossible for foreign countries to send their sugar into the United States. These men were about to lose their fortunes. So they asked themselves, what can we do? How can we keep sending our sugar into the United States? They came up with a marvelously ingenious answer. It was, we'll just become part of the United States. So the leader of their group went to Washington, presented their case to the administration of President Benjamin Harrison. The president approved of this idea and instructed the State Department and the Navy Department, which was then a very important part of American foreign policy, to cooperate with these Hawaiian revolutionaries, as they styled themselves. That revolution was carried out in a matter of just a few hours. The white planters held a meeting. They pronounced that the revolution had taken place, the monarchy was overthrown, and we are now the new government. The Queen was about to respond when suddenly the U.S. ambassador called ashore from a ship anchored just off Honolulu Bay, 250 U.S. Marines. They came ashore to guard the new government. That made it impossible for the Queen to fight, and with that simple expedient, Hawaiian monarchy ceased to exist, and white rule descended over that country. So essentially, the reason that that operation was carried out at all and why Hawaii came into the U.S., why the Hawaiian monarchy disappeared, all started with the interests of sugar planters. That's a pattern that recurs over history.
My guest is Stephen Kinzer, and his new book is Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. And maybe, I don't know, we need to list all 14, but maybe we can get them in during the hour. Give us some of the notable countries where the United States intervened across the world to overthrow a legitimately elected government. And as you said, put in governments whose policies were contrary to the at least the stated ideals of the United States.
I'll give you two examples from the early 1950s. In 1953, the CIA overthrew a government for the first time. That was the elected government of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran. That government committed one terrible sin in the eyes of the West. It was elected. It was democratic. It was respectful of world law, but it did one thing that outraged the West. Iran nationalized its oil industry. That was with a unanimous vote of the Iranian parliament and the fervent support of the prime minister of Iran and the huge majority of the Iranian people. They didn't want to see the profits from Iranian oil going into bank accounts in foreign countries. They wanted to use that money to develop Iran. Because of that, the U.S. stepped in, overthrew the government of Iran in 1953. Now, what was the result of that? We put the Shah back on his throne. The Shah ruled with increasing repression for 25 years. His repression produced the explosion that we call the Islamic Revolution. That revolution brought to power a clique of fanatically anti-American mullahs who started their rule by taking American diplomats hostage and who have spent the last 25 years very actively and sometimes very violently trying to undermine American and Western interests all over the world. Now we are facing a terrible crisis with Iran over its nuclear ambitions. That regime and this crisis never had to emerge. If the United States had not intervened in Iran in 1953, we might have had a thriving democracy in the heart of the Muslim Middle East all these 50 years, and the Middle East would obviously look very, very different.
So this is a massive case, though, a case of the chickens coming home to roost.
One of the things Americans don't realize is that these interventions not only harm the people in the countries where we intervene, but they greatly undermine American national security. They cast whole regions of the world into instability. Now, what is the crucial moment in all these interventions? Now that I've studied them in a row for my book, I see a pattern that emerges time and time again. The crucial moment comes immediately after we overthrow a government. It's never a problem for us to overthrow the government. That's easy enough. But the next day, effectively, we have to decide who's going to be the new leader. Who are we going to put in now? We want a leader that fulfills two qualifications. Number one, he should be popular. It should be somebody that the people of that country will support. And number two, it should be somebody who will do what we want. After all, we didn't intervene just to have somebody in power who doesn't like us. Yeah. So we quickly realize you can't have both. You cannot have a leader who is at the same time popular and responsive principally to the interests of the United States. Leaders of countries are popular because they put the interests of their own country first, ahead of the interest of any power like the United States. But that's not the kind of leader the U.S. wants. So we choose to put in a leader who, although he may not be popular, will do what we want. What happens then? The leader faces increasing opposition and dissent. He has to use more and more repression to keep himself in power. The U.S. then has to come in, either militarily or otherwise, to support him and help him repress his population. That means that people who hate this leader also begin to hate the United States. Their hatred ultimately leads to an explosion, and that explosion leads to the emergence of a regime far more radical and far more anti-American than the one we originally intervened to overthrow.
Stephen Kinzer is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. The book is Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq, and it's published by Times Books. Now, two questions. Well, first, let me say I think that we owe you a debt of gratitude for assembling all this information, because accurate history is so important for us understanding the present and what's possible in the future. But you mentioned at the beginning that you realized you hadn't gone deep enough each time that you had written a book. What was the thought process? What happened either inside you or events that created a change inside of you to make you decide you had to go, as you said, deeper into this?
I think that there are layers and layers of history. You say that I've dug up a lot of history. What I've actually done is tried to dramatize it. I've also tried to show that history can be very exciting and can be told in a lot of stories. What I have seen as I've covered many countries is that you have to look far back in their history to find out what led them to where they are now. Now, in many of these countries, like Iran, for example, or Guatemala, or Cuba, people understand there very, very clearly what the United States did to them. But we don't understand that. And it led me to realize that for countries, as well as for individuals, not everyone sees us the way we see ourselves. And the experience that I had traveling around the world and living actually most of my life abroad allowed me to understand how other people look at the United States. That way, coming back to the U.S. myself, I was able to bring perhaps a little different perspective to the history of American foreign intervention.
Now, you, I just was looking at your index and looking into where Marine General Smedley Butler is mentioned, and he has this very, very famous quote about he was, I forgot what, like a gangster for Wall Street.
Gangster for capitalism.
Okay. In fact, that's the name of his book, isn't it, or something
indeed.
Like that?
Well, his book was called War is a Racket.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Smedley Butler was a fascinating figure. He was the first great hero of the U.S. Marine Corps at a time when most military heroes were coming from the Navy or the Army. He participated in a number of daring foreign adventures in China and Panama and throughout Central America. He was a Medal of Honor winner. And he was engaged in some of the regime change overthrows of foreign governments that we participated in. He got to be such a big hero in the U.S., and so many stories were written about him, that the Marine Corps asked him if he would come back home to the U.S. and take an assignment traveling around the United States, giving speeches about the glories of the Marine Corps and his own experiences. So he agreed, as people in the military are wont to do when their officers tell them what they'd like, and began traveling around the U.S. and speaking. But in his first couple of speeches, he used language like you just cited. He would say, I've spent my career as a gangster for capitalism. I overthrew the government of Nicaragua on behalf of the Morgan Brothers Bank in New York City. And he went through the whole list of the different companies in whose interests he felt he had worked in overthrowing governments or intervening in foreign countries. Well, it didn't take more than a couple of these speeches before the Marine Corps decided that maybe Smedley Butler was not the kind of hero they wanted traveling around the U.S., and they suggested that maybe it was time for him to retire. He did, and went on to write his famous book.
Now, why, though, I mean, you would think then there would not be a necessity for Stephen Kinzer to write a book in 2006 when essentially it's already been written 60 years ago. Why this gulf? What happened in the American popular consciousness or in historical memory that you're virtually breaking new ground again?
Well, you use the key word in your question, which is memory. Historical memory is something that the United States doesn't have much of. We're a very forward-looking people. We don't look back. In fact, I think there are some people in Washington who believe that because the United States is so powerful now, because it's in a situation different from what any great power has ever been in before, the lessons of history do not apply to us anymore. That there really isn't any point in studying history because we are now so powerful. We can dominate history. We can control history. History as an independent force has stopped happening because we have reached this level of power. What I'm trying to point out is that history is still happening, and that as we look even in our most modern interventions, we can see the same patterns that we see in our interventions from 100 years ago. It's time for Americans to realize that these interventions, these overthrows of foreign governments, actually turn out to have terrible results in the end. When you overthrow a foreign government, you are doing something like releasing a wheel at the top of a hill. You never know how it's going to bounce or where it's going to end.
You had a career. I mean, I assume you're not doing active reporting in the manner that you did over the majority of your career. Do you miss that at all, being out there in the field, bullets flying and seeing the aftermath of wars? Or is
I spent a number of years in very difficult situations like the ones you described. I've been beaten by police. I've been jailed. I've been shot at. I've been tear gassed. I've been bombed from the air. I think I've had my fill of that now. But it's not just because I felt I had run out of good luck and I think I'd better quit before disaster strikes. There was also another reason. I wanted to pull back and try to think about these conflicts that I was covering. Let me give you one example. You talked about my work in Nicaragua. Now, Nicaragua has been a miserably poor and conflict-ridden country for 100 years. But it wasn't always that way in the first decade of the 20th century. Nicaragua had a visionary leader. His name was Zelaya. He was a modernizing liberal. He had been educated in Europe. He even brought home a Belgian wife. He built ports and schools and railroad lines. He paved the first street street in Nicaragua and put the first street lights up and imported the first car. Of course, he had to import a driver also because nobody there knew how to drive. So this guy was trying to transform Nicaragua from a clerically dominated feudal state to a modern capitalist nation. But he started bothering some American companies that were working in Nicaragua. He refused to take out loans from American banks. He took out loans from British and French banks. He came into conflict with an American lumber company and with an American mining company. And these companies then complained to Washington. Washington then persuaded itself that Zelaya was a threat to American interests, and he was overthrown. From that moment on, Nicaragua entered its long century of instability. The period after Zelaya was dominated by a new president that we put in office who had been the accountant for the American mining company that caused all the trouble in the first place. His rule naturally produced a lot of discontent. The U.S. Marines had to land in Nicaragua. They stayed there for 20 years. Finally, we imposed the Somoza family dictatorship there. That lasted for 40 years. It was finally brought down by the Sandinista uprising. This whole cycle of intervention and conflict, which has been accompanied by terrible poverty and suffering in Nicaragua, was all set off when the United States violently intervened to interrupt the normal development of politics in Nicaragua. Nicaragua could have been a prosperous state that was a source of stability in Central America and a model of democracy. Instead, it's just the opposite.
The Marines in Nicaragua for 20 years in the first part of the 20th century, the rebel leader leading them lent his name eventually years later, decades later, to the Sandinistas, and I'm forgetting what his name was.
Augusto Sandino.
Sandino, that's
there is
right.
Probably yeah. No country in the world where you can trace more directly the effects of American intervention. So we overthrew Zelaya. That was in 1909. Shortly thereafter, we had to send in Marines to support the very unpopular regime that we had imposed. To rebel against that Marine intervention, Sandino launched his uprising. After Sandino was finally killed, the United States decided that instead of having its own military in Nicaragua, we would impose a local dictator, which is what we did. That lasted for 40 years, but after the first 20 years, another rebellion began, and those rebels named themselves after the guy who had rebelled against the Marines several decades earlier. So we are seeing this thread running all the way to today in Nicaraguan history that was all set off by America's intervention in 1909, and it shows you that in the long term, the results of these interventions are totally unpredictable. You can never imagine what is going to happen years and decades later. But the true effects finally do become clear, and they're never positive for the United States.
Stephen Kinzer, we're almost out of time. You reported from Nicaragua, and your dispatches were very important in the New York Times during that period to those of us up here trying to figure out what in the hell was going on. But as I remember, it was the Reagan administration that put pressure on the New York Times to remove you when you were too close to the story? Wasn't that what they said at the time?
I think there were some people in Washington who didn't like my reporting from Nicaragua during the 1980s. I spoke to some of their representatives, and I asked them what they were unhappy about. After all, I said, I am hardly a propagandist for the Sandinista regime. I am explaining all of the unhappiness with what's going on here. What is it that you don't like about my reporting? And one guy associated with the Reagan administration said something to me that I thought was very interesting. He said, it's not the way that you portray these Sandinistas who we hate that is our problem with you. Our problem is just that you're portraying them as normal people. They get up in the morning. They fall in love. They fall out of love. They go to work. Everything in Nicaragua is happening as it happens in every country. People do the normal things that everyone else does. That's making these people into normal figures. It humanizes them. Yeah. That makes it so much more difficult for us to demonize them and make it clear to Americans that that is some kind of a brutally oppressive tyranny down there. So I think the mere fact of reporting regularly from these countries is what is the sin, not necessarily the content of the reports.
And I'm picking at my memory here. Weren't you brought back to the United States and, like, assigned to a police beat?
That never actually happened. I had a few close calls, but in the end, the New York Times supported me, and they were able to keep me on the job long enough so that I could retire and come out and write this new book.
With a new book, Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. Stephen Kinzer, a celebrated journalist and now the author of this brand new book, Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. Get it. It's important information. Stephen Kinzer, thanks for having joined me on the Peter Werbe Show.
It's a thrill to be with you. Thanks.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Yeah. More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you. I'm here in the radio station, and I look around, and there are women DJs. I see people of African-American background. It's an Asian person, actually. In other words, our workplace here at the station is sort of what we, most of us at least, come to expect from a diverse work situation in the United States. But it wasn't always like that. It certainly wasn't, even like 50 years ago. And how did it all happen? Well, the book is Freedom is Not Enough, The Opening of the Workplace and the American Workplace. And our guest is Nancy McLean, the author. She's a professor of history and African-American studies at Northwestern University. And we're talking to her in Chicago. Nancy McLean, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be talking with you.
Is it simple enough just to say 50 years ago, 60 years ago, it was just mostly white men that were in the most important roles? Is it a history deeper than that in a sense?
I think that's pretty much the picture that you would see in the mid-1950s, with the important exception of black-owned businesses and institutions. There you would see African-Americans in professional or managerial positions, and sometimes women as well. But by and large, in the mainstream of the American economy, it was a situation in which you could almost read off who would be doing various jobs by their demographics. You know, if you were a black woman, you'd be in a particular position, perhaps, cleaning or doing some kind of work like that. If you were a white woman, you were likely to be in a secretarial position or perhaps an operative position if you were working in a factory. If you're a white man, of course, there were many white male workers in blue-collar occupations, but all the main, supervisory, professional, and management positions were held by white men. So, you know, I think we also can forget now how very different things looked 50 years ago. So that's really what I was trying to figure out in doing this research, is how did we get from there to here? How did we get to a situation where people take it for granted that we should be working in diverse workplaces and are struck by the strangeness of it when they go into a place that doesn't have that diversity?
Now,
how did the culture change so much?
I think if everyone who's listening or stopping and think about it quickly, as you more or less introduced the subject, that we know, yes, there was a civil rights movement, there was a women's movement, a feminist movement, there was, and suddenly the official ideology, if you will, supported the idea of a diverse workforce and diversity in general, legally, culturally, what have you. What is different about your book, Freedom is Not Enough, to a story that that has been told?
Well, I think it has been told in the sense that most of us assume that the civil rights movement played a role, the women's movement played a role, the, Mexican-American civil rights movement played a role. But how that happened, we don't actually know, and there wasn't much literature out there. When I started to work on this, there wasn't a kind of social history that would tell us how that came about. And so what I tried to do in my work was really recover the intense grassroots organizing that went on all around the country in things like workplace caucuses and community organizations, in, large organizations like the NAACP and the National Organization for Women, and small groups that were sort of, more ad hoc in local communities. But there were really pretty fierce struggles in communities all around the country to try to open up these workplaces. So it didn't just happen automatically because the Civil Rights Act passed and outlawed employment discrimination, or because these social movements existed. What I've really tried to show is how much of their effort these social movements focused on the workplace, because they just saw access to good jobs as essential to full citizenship, and also saw jobs as a kind of a key measure of belonging. And so people were really angry that they weren't allowed to have a chance at, not just some jobs, a restricted spectrum, but at all jobs, whether that was skilled blue-collar work in the building and construction trades, or whether that was, professional jobs in law and medicine, or managerial jobs. It was really going on right across the class spectrum.
I'm always so appreciative and sometimes even amazed at the imagination of authors and researchers such as yourself, because one has to imagine that there's another facet that's untold. What in there, or what did you come across that made you think, well, wait a minute, there's an untold story here?
Well, actually, I was spurred to this by students. When I started on this work was in the early 90s, and conservative-funded student and campuses around the country were organizing against affirmative action in a pretty aggressive and a pretty ugly way. And some of the students who were shocked who were offended by that came to me and were asking about how affirmative action policies came into being. And when I went to look for resources for them, you know, and things that would be interesting for them to read about where it came from, I realized that those things just weren't there. So that really got me into the archives. And then when I was there, I just found incredible riches. I mean, I think, you know, if your listeners were to go into some place like the Walter Reuther Library at Wayne State and just start asking for the collections from the Union Records for the 1960s and the 1970s, I think they'd be astonished at how much was going on in the local community or, you know, in the records that come in from around the country. It's just really invigorating stuff, too, where you just see people being very, you know, sort of creative and taking these ideas that were out there in the air in the 60s and all the talk about democracy and equality and freedom and saying, hey, you know, we need some of that at work. This isn't just about having the right to eat at, you know, lunch counters or, you know, to go to desegregated schools. This is about how we earn our livelihoods and support our families and where we get the power to, you know, make life decisions. And people really turned a lot of attention to the workplace in a way that I don't think has really been part of the way that the civil rights movement, the black civil rights movement, the women's movement, or the Mexican-American civil rights movement has been told so far.
Do you think white men have finally gotten over it? I don't think so entirely.
Well, one of the things actually that I try to point out in my work, because sometimes I sort of feel a little sympathetic to white men with a sort of blanket criticism, because I know, you know, from my own experience, there's a lot of really great white men out there who have been allies of these struggles. And certainly, you know, you see that in some of the union situations where, you know, not everyone was an ally, but even in the hardest situations, like the building and construction trades, you know, if you talk to women in the trades or, you know, to African Americans in the trades, usually it wasn't a universally hostile group of white men. You know, there were always at least a minority, one or two people, you know, who looked out for people, who tried to cut through the racism and the sexism, who acted as allies that helped people to endure. So I really try to, you know, to remind us of that and get us thinking politically about why it was that the more conservative white men and the more sort of powerful conservative movement, for that matter, was able to increase divisions among groups in the ways that they were.
My guest is Nancy McLean on the Peter Werbe Show. Her book is Freedom Is Not Enough, The Opening of the American Workplace, and it is published by, is it Russell Sage Foundation or Harvard?
Co-published by, Harvard University Press and Russell Sage Foundation.
I brought this up in kind of a, with a jocular tone in my voice about white men. But usually when you dig deeply into these situations where racism or sexism prevails, you very frequently find that what we're calling conservative men, as opposed to an ideologically conservative movement, we're talking about men who are fearful about the economic impact of relinquishing that privilege that they enjoy. So that when you only have white men able to get a job, it's one thing. Suddenly, if you have women, and as you indicate, I never thought about it like this, that the majority of Americans, women and people of color, were excluded. So the majority of Americans were excluded from access to any number of occupations, certainly in mine, in broadcasting. There was good reason in many ways for that anxiety, that economic anxiety that became expressed in opposition to these movements for equality.
And actually, some people in the movement really understood that that was a problem and a potential pitfall. And so Martin Luther King, Bayard Rustin, A. Philip Randolph, you know, there's a whole sort of stream of thought in the civil rights movement that tried to change the whole game, you know, not just bring more people to the table, but make the whole system more equitable through things like the Freedom Budget, which was a big campaign in 1966 and 1967. In particular, but to get the government to essentially create a situation of full employment, to fund jobs, to do things like building good housing, you know, in the cities, supporting better schools, providing health care. So basically create jobs to do the things that were needed to address the urban crisis. And because of providing those jobs, they believed that that would allay kind of white backlash and prevent the kind of situation you're talking about of people feeling like this was a zero-sum situation and that somebody, you know, again for a black woman or, you know, or for an African-American man would somehow be a loss for a white worker. Now, they weren't strong enough in the end to do that, to reshape the whole political economy. But I think it's really important today to remember that, that people did try and they did have that vision. But part of the reason that they, the biggest reason they weren't successful was the power of the conservative movement, which is another story I tell in tension with this, the struggles for equality in the book, because I see the growing strength of the conservative movement as being ultimately the most important reason why these struggles didn't, in the end, yield more.
Well, the conservatives have been on the wrong side of every social struggle since 1776. I mean, this is true. They've opposed every single, you know, they wanted to remain a colony of Britain. They they opposed the abolitionists. They supported slavery. They supported segregation. They supported every war, yeah, on and on and on. They opposed the union movement. They opposed you know, feminist and gay rights movements. And They don't have a pretty history. So they essentially, the ones that didn't leave for Canada, the Tories, they essentially would have been okay, given what they've opposed through the years, with the vote, and hence, as we're talking about employment, being restricted to white propertied males.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. But I think it's also important to realize that, that probably, I don't know, but I would guess most people in your listening audience may not understand that deep history of the conservative movement. You know, I think conservatives have been very effective at repackaging themselves and kind of in some way sanitizing their message since the 1970s in particular. But yeah, I mean, as you say, it, from its founding in the mid-1950s as a, you know, as a the beginnings of a social movement with the National Review magazine started by William F. Buckley in 1955, the conservative movement was a great ally of the segregationists and actually made the man who developed the philosophical rationale for massive resistance to Brown versus Board of Education, the National Review made that man, James Kilpatrick, its spokesperson on civil rights and the Constitution. And as you say, I mean, they opposed, they basically said no, 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 and no, you know, to every single measure that would have promoted equality in these years and that would have corrected for, you know, generations of disadvantaging African Americans and women. And I think it's really important for us to remember that history and kind of remember where they came from and how much also over time they were able to shape the terms of debate and, you know, act in Congress in ways that blocked more substantial change from happening, you know, that blocked things that would have given everybody more economic security with which to engage these questions about racial and gender equity. So I think that's a really important piece of the puzzle. But what they did, what I found them doing in my work is developing a kind of jiu-jitsu where they've turned to this language of colorblindness that takes the power of the civil rights movement and the power of the ideas of, you know, justice and equality and uses them against reform and against inclusion, you know, and you see that in the talk of reverse discrimination and in the attacks on affirmative action. And so I think they've been very effective, actually, at reframing their cause in a way that makes it more palatable to, you know, large numbers of people, hence their success, you know, in all three, controlling all three branches of government at this point.
Looks like the House of Cards is collapsing, but let's, I brought them up, but I'm thinking we could spend a lot of time talking essentially about people that aren't very, don't have a great vision of what, of completing essentially the American Revolution, the inclusion of everyone in the definitions of what initially was the founding fathers' vision. Of course, at that time, they only included white property males, but we've, over the course of American history, of course, extended the franchise and the inclusion of people to the extent that we have so far. A long way to go, but there's heroes along the way. So rather than talking about frightened, greedy, and mean people, let's talk about the heroes of democracy, the people that really did participate in your subtitle, The Opening of the American Workplace. There's lots of them in your book, Freedom is Not Enough, but maybe single out one or two and tell us who you were really impressed with when you actually met them or researched them.
Well, one person I was particularly impressed with is a man named Warless Jackson, who was a veteran of the Korean War, father of five, had been working for 11 years at the Armstrong Rubber Plant in Natchez, Mississippi in 1967, and he had been an active participant in the very vibrant civil rights movement in Mississippi in those years, trying to do things like get better schools for black children in the community, trying to open up the downtown department stores to black workers, trying to get the vote, trying to do, you know, a very broad-ranging agenda. And as part of that, he and others were fighting to desegregate the Armstrong rubber plant, to basically get the management there to abide by the Civil Rights Act that had been passed a few years before. And he actually lost his life in that struggle. He was promoted to a skilled job that had been considered white man's work, and his truck, a bomb was placed in his truck one night when he was coming home from work, and he lost his life in that struggle. And this is one of these Mississippi murders that has never been investigated, never been solved, but his active participation and his wife's participation in the movement prior to that, and the example of, you know, in effect his martyrdom, really further galvanized the struggle in Mississippi and enabled some of the more far-reaching changes that occurred. So I look at him as being, you know, just one of the unsung heroes whose contribution and whose sacrifice opened up workplaces to the rest of us. And now there are many other people whose stories were not so tragic. And sometimes, you know, as all social movements have, there were times where people actually had fun in organizing, you know, and they mocked the employers, and they, you know, they used ridicule for power. So there's those stories too. But his story particularly moved me because it really showed the stakes, you know, he knew that he was taking a risk, and that movement knew that people were taking incredible risks, but they were devoted enough to this vision of full citizenship for themselves and their children that they were really willing to take on odds like that. There are other people from actually your listening area, the Detroit area, who stand out to my mind as heroes. Someone like Dorothy Hayner, who was a UAW member and a union activist for many, many years, who actually carried the struggle for women's equality even before the Civil Rights Act and even before, you know, most people even imagined there was a feminist movement. You know, she was working with others in the 50s and in the early 60s for things like child care for working mothers, you know, trying to prevent women from being discriminated against for being pregnant, trying to open up skilled work that had been closed to women, you know, doing all kinds of things like that. So she would be another. I mean, there's just one of the things I actually tried to do with the book is really tell it through personal stories and personal vignettes, because the more I found out about any of these individuals, the more powerful their stories became. And, you know, it's kind of a cumulative combined effect of all of those individual and collective acts that made for the change that we saw.
Well, Nancy McLean, also, these movements just didn't pop out of nowhere. You've mentioned the UAW several times, mm-hmm. in the Walter Reuther Archive at Wayne State University in Detroit. I was at an event last Saturday at Local 174 in Romulus, and that's the old West Side local that Walter Reuther was founded. And there's a huge mural from Works Progress Administration that shows a male and a female worker, and this was done like in 1937 or 1938. Mm-hmm. So there was agitation for a lot of things that didn't occur till decades later, going on even as far back as then. And the same with the black struggle.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I really hope to kind of restore to our collective memories with these stories is a sense of how much the struggles and the advances of the 1960s built on the achievements of the 1930s. I think there's a certain way that, you know, in kind of the years of the New Left and Black Power and whatnot, people put emphasis on the limitations of the labor movement and the limitations of the New Deal. And I think, you know, those are important issues, and there were some real limitations there, but we should not let us forget the tremendous achievement of the labor movement and of the changes in government that happened in those years, because all of the 60s achievements rested on, you know, having a government that had to respect the social rights of its citizens, right? A government that could intervene with business. You know, it was first intervening with business to protect the rights of labor unionists that established the foundation for government then to intervene with business to act against discrimination. And similarly, you know, the labor movement certainly has had, you know, its flaws and it's got its more progressive wings and its more conservative wings, but the tools that labor provided for enforcing equality were incredible. I mean, having contracts, for example, that could have anti-discrimination clauses which workers could enforce, having grievance committees that enable people to protest injustice that they encounter on a day-to-day basis, all of those things are real levers of power for rank-and-file workers, and they came out of that earlier struggle. So the way that I understand this story is very much that the activists of the 60s, whether they always realized it or not, were standing on the shoulders of the activists of the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
You know, so much in this country is based on what I call, or I probably stole this phrase from somewhere, the politics of resentment. Mm-hmm. So it's very possible that we have white men like myself listening, and they're thinking, yeah, that's nice, but what's in it for me? I'm just close to getting screwed as it is, as more plants close and go overseas, and the, you know, these so smart managers ruin another company.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything in it for the people that that previously had at least a modicum of privilege above the others?
Well, I think I suppose that depends on which people, but I think, you know, for working people, the fact that we had these deep divisions between blacks and whites and between men and women endangered the gains of even the workers who seemed to be privileged, you know, and sadly I think we see that today where people who, you know, had good union jobs that had private pensions and private health coverage, you know, and who are losing those, well, we're partly doing that because of the race and gender issues that kept us from having government do that for everybody, so that now some employers feel those plans are too expensive for them to sustain. So some employers are actually fleeing not to, you know, Mexico or the Philippines, but to Canada, where there's universal health care, so their health care overhead isn't as high. So I don't know, maybe that's a little bit abstract, but I think, you know, even in terms of women's equality, I'll bet many people in your listening audience have at different points relied on the income of wives to sustain a household when men were out of work or on layoff or something like that. So, you know, I think that in the way that most of us live our family lives now and our community lives, I think, you know, we can see that everybody benefits when they're when women have more chances. And similarly, I think conservatives have sold us such a bill of goods to think that white people benefit from holding down black people in such a way that then, you know, you end up with despair and you end up with anger and crime and things like that. And I think, you know, this is the wealthiest country in the world. This is a country that's shown great creativity and vision sometimes over the years. And I think that we have the resources to provide equality,
sure,
and provide good life chances for all of our children. And we should really be about the business of doing that.
Yeah, I think if we want a peaceful community, we have to have a fair community. A fair community,
right,
is a peaceful community. We're almost out of time with Nancy McLean. You're a professor of history and African-American studies at Northwestern University. You're from European background, what we commonly call white, yet you're a professor of African-American studies. Is that unusual?
I don't actually think it's that unusual. I think it's probably contrary to lots of people's expectations, but we have at Northwestern a very large and vibrant African-American studies program that is eager to involve, you know, people who are doing work on these issues and to create a community of people discussing these issues. So, for example, our African-American studies department just hired someone working in Latino studies and somebody else working in Asian American studies because they're interested in thinking about race, you know, sort of beyond black and white and thinking comparatively and engaging these things politically. So it's a very vibrant and diverse community that's anchored, though, by African Americans and African American leadership. And so for me, it's just really a pleasure to be part of those conversations.
And it's an extraordinary history because it's mostly a hidden history. So, I mean, we all know about George Washington at Valley Forge, although there's lots of myths about that. But the history of people of African descent in the United States has always fascinated me, and I don't mean that, certainly don't mean that in any patronizing way. It's in many ways, those hidden histories illuminate the official histories.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the African-American experience is just so absolutely central to American history and to, you know, sort of the ugliest moments of American history in terms of, say, slavery or, you know, some of the race riots or things like that, the sort of, you know, the worst moments of American history, but also the best moments. I think in many ways African Americans have been the moral conscience of America. I mean, consistently, you know, certainly throughout the late 19th century and the 20th century, from kind of the abolition movement in the 19th century on, it's really been African Americans who have pushed for a very inclusive vision of American citizenship, for treating the Declaration of Independence, Declaration that all men are created equal, as really the founding text of our nation. For, you know, they've pushed for trying to get universal benefits, you know, so that just like the freedom budget I was describing before, so that by benefiting the most vulnerable citizens, you would actually benefit all citizens. So I think that in studying African American experience, you really get a window into the deepest, most profound moments in American in the American past.
The book is Freedom Is Not Enough, The Opening of the American Workplace. It's published by Russell Sage Foundation and Harvard, Harvard University Press. My guest has been Nancy McLean. I'll have a link to this on my website, peterwerby.com. Nancy McLean, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Peter. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
cops give up their dead. What did you expect to find? Was it something you left behind? Don't you remember?
Belleville, New Baltimore, and Chesterfield. All rock with the rare, made in the Motor City.
I've never been happier in my life.
101 WRIX. Everything that rocks.
Rocks. How hard you try, you can't stop us now. No matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now.